welcome to Night Shift Delirium, a podcast about junior doctors and the world that surrounds them. I'm Victoria, your host, a junior doctor based in England. And on this week's bonus episode, we're talking about what it means to be a minority in the UK. Given my very limited time here, I wanted to amplify the voices of two people who were born and raised here and are very familiar with the minority experience. You'll hear from Dorothy, who you all have heard many times on the podcast so far, and Nadia about their experiences in the BAME community, as it is called in the UK. BAME stands for Black, Asian, Minority Ethnic. This episode initially started as a recording of a snippet of conversations that we'd had throughout the night, but turned into a full-blown episode. Consequently, you'll hear in this episode lots of background noise and people doing work because we didn't realize we were going to be recording as long as we were. Anyway, let's jump into the conversation and welcome to our shift.
I think part of the discussion I was having with Victoria is that the experience of being a black woman can be quite tiresome, as awesome as it is, you know, but it's more from more the external factors. So often, you know, if we are opinionated, if we have our views and, you know, or if we say something, it's often taken as aggression, is often taken as us being too forward. So sometimes people are subconsciously suppressing who they are naturally to fit into a narrative that's incorrect placed on by other people. So that's often a lot of black women's experience, particularly as professionals in the workplace. Luckily for Victoria and I, we are very much embraced. But you do know that there are some people think, oh, you know, they're a bit forward, or they, you know, they're quite opinionated.
I think many years ago, I just realized it wasn't worth living under the white gaze, and it was just worth embracing myself in its entirety.
Because you're never gonna meet the expectation.
No, and I have no interest in it because my.
And why should you try?
You shouldn't try.
Why should you try and meet the expectation? And what is the purpose of that expectation?
Yeah.
It's to silence,
satisfy
you.
a voice that doesn't support you, that doesn't raise you up. But I think we were talking. I made an interesting point as well about how the. Because I think I made a comment that in the rank of priority of issues about race, microaggressions were lower. But actually, you made a good point, Victoria, about how actually the comments, the remarks about the way you speak or the way you might be a bit loud or the way you your culture might be questioned in a way that you don't feel other people's are, that makes you have internalised a lot of shame and a lot of constant questioning about not meeting a norm. And that shame actually reflects on your opportunities, because then you might not necessarily put yourself forward, you lack the confidence, you don't necessarily pursue things, and it ends up being a reflection. If you're not meeting the goals or society's like view of success, you think, oh, it's because of who I am, but actually it's just as big as overt racism, saying, well, we gave the job to a white person. But even then, you might not have presented yourself.
You thwarted the opportunity of somebody else because they thought that because of the way they
felt like
viewed,
you deserve it.
They deserve it. So I'll have young people, I'll say, oh, you know, your grades are good enough for Oxbridge. You know, well, people like me don't go to Oxbridge.
Yeah.
Like, who are people like you? Mm-hmm. These are the grades that Oxbridge want. You satisfy the requirements, but they don't believe they satisfy the requirement because they've internalized that people like me are not good enough. And
you won't fit in even if you are good enough.
Exactly.
You won't be made to feel like you belong. And that everyone wants to belong. It's fundamentally of like you seek that in your job, in your friendships, in your relationships. But I remember I wanted to be an architect, and my dad said to me, people with the last name Abdullah don't become architects. And I was like thinking about it, but he's not wrong. It's not going to be easy. In a architecture is very much a dominant of a white male, and I did work experience in an architecture office. Everyone was male. I felt really uncomfortable, and that was put off it because I was like, I can't work in this environment. It's too And I have a friend who's Iraqi and an architect, and she's amazing. And I thought, I never felt like I could go into that space because I was never... And I thought it was my fault. I thought, well, I don't belong there. And then that is where that microaggression comes in, and it stops you opening those doors for people who don't traditionally get opportunities.
Get into those spaces. Yeah. And I think that's one thing I've mentioned to Victoria before. I don't know if I've mentioned it on a podcast, is something I'm so passionate about, and it's about increasing representation, and that's across the board.
Yeah.
Not just in race, but also with class.
Yeah.
So, for example, I was saying yesterday that, you know, medicine is quite elitist, and 100%. I mean, how can you serve a community but then only one particular type of people are serving that community? So that's why I think representation is very important. Yeah. I think this conversation started when we were talking about outcomes for Black women in childbirth,
yeah.
And then we're also talking about, you know, sickle cell, how it's managed in the UK, and I gave two examples about where there was a good ethnic representation in the leadership of certain medical departments when I was in medical school and I was in York, and how their presence changed the way the culture in which they practiced. They were more able to adapt and to serve all members of the community because the members of the community were represented in the leadership. So that's why it's really important, like just like this Iraqi lady as an architect, that now makes someone think, of course I can enter this space. Someone has this surname. Look at what Edward Emanfo has been able, I don't know if I said his surname, how he's changed beauty just by the fact that he is the Vogue editor-in-chief.
Yeah. Exactly. It's flipped it on its head. I think it's definitely not just representation in what you see, it's representation in leadership. And it is, I do believe in, you know, in the society we live, you need people being paid in roles, you need people being employed in higher paying roles, because why shouldn't they get paid? It shouldn't just be, oh, there's more diverse actors on TV and there's more, you know, at certain you know, in theatre shows they're blind casting, but that is one very, very small part of an industry, and you don't really hear that many conversations about how you do it in other
professional
vocations. And so, like, yes, of course, in like office spaces and things like that, but medicine is a very unique industry and it's a very unique vocation. And the UK, we rely on overseas doctors, but if you actually look at UK trained doctors, a lot of them are white. And actually, the ones who perform better and get into higher seniorship, like Dot made a really good point about experiences that we might have had in workplaces we've worked in, the leadership is dominated by UK-trained white men. That is what we see.
And I think it's important because you almost said they're people who perform better. They're not,
it's not performing better
at all. They just happened to
climb,
speak the same lingo,
but
know the same coffee shops.
I find that so funny. But the person, the people provided the service, their performance is enough for them to provide the service.
That's the thing.
But it's not okay for them to manage the service.
So
they can't manage the service that they're providing. So I find that very interesting.
They fill the roles where there's gaps, but they're not welcomed into the next part, the next level up. And that I didn't really think about until, and especially in medicine, because...
And we'll give an example. I said something. I said, let's take an audit of the non-UK, people of non-British heritage that run the night shifts in the hospital. And I can guarantee my life from now to December that 95% of them will not be UK-trained doctors. Or what, let me know UK-trained, sorry. I would say... Of British heritage,
of Caucasian,
and if people, it's a known thing, but it's actually the reality of the NHS. It's not a new thing. It's not a secret. It's a reality. You ask 10 people what's the name of your GP, and 8 of those GPs will not have a British surname.
And I'm sorry. I think that's really important to note when we talk about health disparities, we look at COVID, we look at things. Cultural competency is so important in health, and we're trying to understand why there's a discrepancy despite alleged equal access to care. And I say alleged because if you're Black, you might not be offered the same tests and examinations that your white counterpart might.
But at least you take out the money and the finance.
Exactly. So one bit is controlled for, but the other bit isn't. And then you look at the people making decisions and they don't even look like their staff.
Yeah.
How could they even possibly understand?
I think a few really important things, like I always want to act, like I think about what I want from my doctor and from my healthcare and what I'd want from my family. And I want to act and reflect that. And then it's very hard to act that way if you don't have a come from a background where you think your family might not be taken seriously or might not be represented, or they might not understand your... So, like, Middle Eastern people were really highly affected by COVID, and my dad's an A&E consultant. And I was like, Dad, what are they doing to protect you? Like, are they taking you out of the red zone? And they hadn't done anything. They hadn't even considered it. And he's an over 60-year-old man who's Middle Eastern, who's, you know, yes, he's well and doesn't have many comorbidities, but he's still a high-risk patient. And no one had even had that conversation with him. No one even had that assessment, even though it's in the news. It's common knowledge because it's not their family member. It's not their own experience. So I want to practice in the way that I want to feel like I... So I will think about people's ethnicity. I will think about people's backgrounds. I will want them to feel comfortable and like they can be fully open despite potential cultural differences and things like that, because you see it yourself. So that's why you need people who can experience it and understand that in leadership roles, because exactly like you said about your story about the midwife who told who gave you really good teaching about how Black women, you know,
how their anatomy may affect the way that they progress in labor. And because, like I said, the consultants there, the obstetrician and gynecologist there, two of them were of Nigerian heritage. And then the other English doctor also lived in Nigeria and had that exposure to how, you know, Black women present in health. They were able to adapt their service with the new influx of, I think they had an influx of people of Somali heritage.
Yeah.
So they were able to adapt their birthing experience to make it, to optimize it for those ladies.
Yeah.
And I found that so profound. I really enjoyed her teaching. I learned so much even about my anatomy from that. But I could see how representation had improved this, you know, middle class English lady's practice.
That enthusiasm about ensuring all patients were given optimized care, that enthusiasm needs people who have, you know, empathy behind it. And that's not saying that people of, you know, white backgrounds, like you said, that person was white, but they have to be actively interested in it. There needs to be a drive to support these patients. So you can't just fix a quota. So like the statistic that we were talking about was that when Black women in the UK are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth, so mortality is 5 times higher in the UK, not internationally, in the UK, which is an absurd statistic. How that can even
be acceptable,
and it's not, you know, talked about every single day, what we are disadvantaged and what we are doing wrong for this population. That is a health crisis. That is, you know, just as much of an issue, but it's a women, and it's women's health, which is always negatively researched and less talked about, and it's, you know, Black women, so it's seen as less of a priority. It's not being pushed. But if it was a problem that affected white people or affected men, it would, and that we found that men were 5 times more likely, say like heart disease, men are more, you hear about heart disease, every GP is having proformas about what is their heart disease risk, preventative treatment. Why are we not thinking and doing the same thing to stop that mortality? Because these are young women, this is childbirth, they shouldn't be having too many comorbidities. What is going wrong? It doesn't make any sense. So that, I think, is where we still have a lot of issues.
And it's crazy because we're having these issues in 2020.
Yeah.
I won't mention any names, but there was quite a prominent dean who gave, of a prominent medical school, who gave an example about how some things are just not even thought about when it comes to BAME or you know, Black patients. And a young junior doctor referred a Black patient to a dermatologist.
Mm.
And the dermatologist goes, well, if it was on normal skin. If it was on normal skin.
Oof.
And this was in the heat of the whole George Floyd
that is upsetting
situation, and that medical student complained. And then when my sister and I discussed the matter, because my sister is a medical student as well, and it's actually happened at her deanery in London of all places.
Yeah.
And you know, that junior doctor, sorry, not medical student, complained and whatever. But then
my sister and I
thought, how many black people do we see in medical books? And yeah. I think there's a young black doctor that's now trying to make...
Yeah, she's from Bristol Uni.
Yeah, trying to make it more, you know, more prominent in medical books. But you don't. You will not see it as if, you know, we're not a race.
But it's not like you can't... It's not like we don't see it. We have black patients. We have black patients who have it. So you take a picture. I don't see why it's so difficult. Take a picture.
But it's, you know, it's not. And, you know...
Because blackness and minorities in general are not a priority.
They're only a priority, and it's just like kind of how it's presented in the media. We're only discussed when it's, oh, schistosomiasis or dengue, or, you know, it's all these tropical diseases, because, yeah, you know, African, we are these, you know, we're a museum, you know, these African stereotypes. It was only a disease when it's malaria. We could never have heart disease. We could never lupus. Have COPD, lupus. Or
that is autoimmune. This is a genetic problem that has been happening for well-researched many years, that is like a lifelong limiting condition.
But
it makes
black
no sense.
People are limited to these tropical diseases, and yeah, that's when you hear about, oh yeah, there's an African lady that came from here and here, and, you know, oh, she's definitely, you know, got HIV or
yeah
whatnot,
the HIV
or
thing
whatever.
Still exists,
and you're just thinking, no, people, like, come on, we're in the United Kingdom. Like, how is HIV not stratified against across every race? But, you know, so that's what that story really brought out, how it was so easy for a consultant dermatologist to say...
In London, which is
normal skin is Caucasian skin.
Shamelessly.
I just found that quite absurd and, like, disturbing.
That's upset. I would be upset by that.
Yeah, so it's really... It's
But it's like that a lot. It's that microaggression. Why is a black person not a normal patient?
And see,
it's like they put
that statement doesn't even make sense.
But for me, that's not even a microaggression. That's full on aggression.
Oh yeah, that's
that is.
Yeah.
Do you know, to find someone as abnormal?
Yeah,
it's just it's insane. But do you know what? At the same time, you know, for me, I'm not a problem dispenser. I feel that, you know, I like to be solution driven. People be people. But I think what we should be very grateful for and happy for is that our generation of medics, okay, all three of us are children of medics.
Yeah.
And the conversation we can have now, our parents probably couldn't have.
Yeah, that's true.
When they were at our level.
Yeah.
That we could openly discuss these situations with our consultant, with our white colleagues, expose them. I think one of the beauties of this conversation was we're all from, I think, 4 or 5 different countries are represented here. And everyone...
Sorry, y'all. As promised, there are other people in the room, and you're going to hear a bit of background noise. That one in particular was from one of our colleagues. We'll call him Jean. And he was a bit microphone shy, so we didn't record him.
Hearing your experience, Nadia, is still different to my experience.
Yeah,
and it's so interesting for you to talk about your experience as an Arab, and my unique experience in its own way.
So, like, there's a lot of universal feelings and underlying emotions, and how it has a long-term effect sometimes. But it's also so unique, even, you know, me and another Arab or two black people's experiences are million miles away, and it depends on where you grew up. And
exactly. So sometimes Victoria and I's experiences are very different, because Victoria's African in America, and I'm an UK-born African in the United Kingdom, and our experiences are different. And even like being, we were saying that even around the UK, your experiences are different. In London, your experience is different to being in Essex and or being in, you know, Shropshire or whatever. So everyone's experiences are very different, but very unified. But I think what's very key was that our ability to have that conversation. I feel that medicine has come very far, and I said speaking to older BAME staff, like consultants, and
yeah,
that a bit even envious of our generation that we can speak up so much and not feel ashamed, whereas they came as immigrants and just thought they had to keep quiet and couldn't really do much and probably missed out opportunities because of that shame or because of that fear. But whereas we're just like, nope, I'm not taking it.
And that's where the next level, the next generation of BAME doctors will then take it into leadership roles because they're like, I'm not being served by my profession, so I'll serve.
And they have the confidence to say it. It's the
and they're not. They look at the older consultants and they're like, that's not my career. I don't want that career where I'm constantly being...
Subordinate.
Yeah, subordinate for working just as hard, sometimes harder.
And for the people
being just as clinically able as my colleagues and my counterparts, but not feeling like I am able to take the steps up and be.
But for the people that are happy to do that, that's fine. But for those who feel that they can step into those positions, like, the world is yours for the taking. Yeah. And I think our generation is definitely
we're very outspoken
here. Yeah. Like, we're not.
But people
were
used to fear. They're not about talking about these things, but they were afraid of their number.
For the people outside of the UK, when we reference our numbers, essentially it's your medical license number or your professional one for nurses and other staff members.
How could you imagine being afraid of your profession and not being able to express how you actually feel?
And how you feel within your profession. How are you ever going to get changed if speaking about... And it's a bit like...
About your livelihood.
If you can't criticise the industry you work with, how is it going to improve? How are doctors who are disadvantaged going to change things if people are scared?
And medicine is so unique because, like you said, it is literally... The NHS in this country is literally surviving because of overseas staff.
Doctors.
Not just doctors.
Yeah.
Nurses. Not just nurses. Other healthcare professionals. Pharmacists.
Yeah.
Literally. I wish it was an exaggeration, but it's not.
Mm. And there is a different... And, like, I'm UK trained, but I am Arabic. But there is a difference in how people are trained. Like, I hear stories about my dad. My dad was a surgeon in Iraq and then came... and had to start as a 40-year-old as an SHO. And he was going to theatre with registrars who were younger and less experienced with him. And he'd done 300 thyroid goiter surgeries and was having to assist. And he was early recognised for his hard work because the only way he was able to progress was because he turned up before everyone else. He stayed late after everyone else, and within a year of being an SHO who was offered a registrar position without and offered direct admission and recommended directly to the college of both surgeons and A&E, and because of, you know, how the situation of training and stuff, he decided to change to A&E because it's quicker, because he did have to think about, he's 40 now, does he want to be a registrar for 7 years? But that kind of thing only happens because he had to work harder.
And I think
he had to work harder and put himself out more to get that initial recognition. The fact that he had 20 years of surgical experience and was one of the most famous surgeons in Iraq, that should have spoken for itself. But no, it was the pure dedication of the fact that he was able to turn up. I remember he told me a story that when he first came to the UK, we had so little money, his shoe had broken. And he had to get chewing gum to stick his shoe together so he could go to work. And he was the humility that comes from being a successful surgeon to having looking at himself being like, I can't replace this. I'm going to have to repair this with chewing gum.
I think all of that is really important when we look at leadership.
Because
our parents and people like us, they were new to the country and really happy to be here. And especially, I think, in the UK and maybe in the States, it's a little bit different. But there's this spirit that you have to be very grateful, keep your head down, work hard.
Work harder.
You'll get acknowledged to a certain level, but don't get carried away. You're not
going
to run this. Like, we're still running this because we gave you the opportunity, despite the fact that you're working your butt off way more than many other people here or whatever. And so... they don't have that confidence, like we spoke about. They have this internalized low self-efficacy when it comes to their potential. And we all saw that. And that's why those are our parents and those are our aunties and uncles. And seeing that has inspired us to be like, you know what? They're more than capable and so am I.
Do you know what it is? It is a low level, or it you know, I love the UK because immigrants are given opportunities and there is mobility for immigrants. But it is a really, it's always celebrated, like the UK love immigrants, but they love them until they stop. They're useful until they're not useful. So look at Windrush and you look at how they were used and they were brought here and they were, and then as soon as they're not useful anymore, it flips. And it's a really insidious way of treating immigrants because you're never feeling secure. So that is why people don't take risks, because they're never given that security, and it's an easy way to dangle. It's like carrot and stick. They're dangling that security, and so you'll keep working hard, because why else? My dad says all the time, we don't know what our future is. He's been here. I've got a British passport. He's got a British passport. He's been here for so long. He's so entrenched. He still has this fear that he might get kicked out one day.
And you have to ask him, how bad is the system to instill that great deep fear in you?
He's 60 and he still thinks that he has to work harder than everyone else because who knows what might happen. And he's definitely, like, it's trickled down to me, and that's scary because I have no life outside of the UK. I've been here since I was a baby. Why should I be scared I'll be kicked out? I shouldn't be scared that I'll be kicked out.
When you're actually feeding the system.
Yeah.
A very integral, very necessary.
But it is, it's almost deliberate, because how else do you get, it's cheap labour.
It's very intentional. Yeah. It is very deliberate. And this is what people talk about when they're talking about racial trauma and generational things. But
that's why I sometimes, you know, I'm very proud of having an immigrant family in the UK, and I'm very proud of how far it's come, but it is,
I love that, because you're speaking as an NPOC.
Yeah.
For those who don't know what an NPOC is,
it's to be fair though, Dot wasn't sure if I do classify as an NPOC, but
I mean, from first time,
well informed. Yeah, and I was saying,
so
an NPOC is it a non-presenting person of color? So I'm Arabic, but I'm very pale.
That was actually a really funny point dropped. Well, I guess it's funny or it's true or whatever, by our registrar, who is half English, half Indian, doesn't look it, but was hit and, you know, kind of gave his experience.
Tell us about what an NPOC is.
Okay, so Jack, who is our registrar and who we absolutely love, he's amazing, was explaining how
just threw out this term.
Yeah, and how what I found interesting was how he thought it necessary to be having this discussion with his 2-year-old son about race and about colour and stuff like that. Jack is half English, half Indian. I'm sure he wouldn't mind us discussing that, and, you know, saying that how actually he's a non-presented person of colour, and so therefore the conversations people will have with him would probably be different. And he probably experiences what I guess everyone defines as white privilege, because he's a non-presented person of colour. But actually, you know, he's seen, you know, possibly some of the, you know, other sides of it as well. So yeah, so that's what an NPOC is.
So, because I'm very fair, people who are very ignorant about what Arabs look like, I think Arab people just think anyone from Asia is South Asian, so it looks like they're from India or Pakistan or something. Whereas the Middle East have a very particular look. So I think if you know what an Arab looks like, you would recognise me as an Arab. But a lot of my patients, you know, say it's so nice to be seen by an English doctor and things like that, which makes me really uncomfortable. And then I introduce myself very pointedly, being like, hello, my name's Dr. Abdullah, and like make a point. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where my name, a patient the other day was like, you speak such good English. And I was like, you do not speak very good English. So you get, it's weird because it's kind of like you have both ends. There are times, and if anything, the thing that makes me more uncomfortable is feeling fraudulently white. Like it's like they're letting me in a way. Like my friend at school, you know, I'd been in school with her from year 7 to year 11, and she was like, I didn't know you weren't white. And I was like, I've been friends with you for 5, you've been to my house, you've met my dad. My dad has an accent. And she was like, I didn't think about it. And I'm like, I don't understand how people, it's like a, it's it's almost like a surprise. And they're like, oh, you did so well at pretending to be white. And I was like, I'm not, it's like, wow, you really passed for one of us. Like, it's a really weird feeling of, I'm not being forthright about enough. Like, I should be saying, by the way, you realise that I'm not white.
It's like, awkward though, because it's like they're almost congratulating you.
Yeah, for being, it is. It's almost like a weird,
identified as one of quote unquote them.
Yeah.
I think, talking about like our parents, I think, one thing I love, really, I think that's helped me really not see, I know, you know, the acknowledgement that there is a barrier that the world wants to put is there, but I never allow that to be a barrier to me.
Yeah.
It's probably because of the experience I've seen with my father, who came here as an immigrant, but decided that that's not going to be my limitation, and was able to enter into leadership positions and to advocate African-Caribbeans in the UK, his community. And I remember, you know, many of his Caucasian colleagues loving him for that. And I think there's actually a place that people want you to feel, but if you don't feel it, they will accept it not being filled. That's what I've actually noticed, that if it's not filled, no one will say anything, but when it is filled, they're like, actually no, this is what we really needed. And you know, I'm close to a lot of my dad's Caucasian colleagues, and they say, you know one thing we loved about Philip was how he unashamedly pushed and advocated for his community, and it was necessary because that understanding we could never have. The opportunities are there, and I think it's up to us to really now just push and keep breaking those barriers down. Even it will be uncomfortable. Then, you know, no change is comfortable, and we've got to be used to not being comfortable.
You need to change.
It's not going to be easy.
Yeah, I think you need to change the viewpoint. So, like, as a immigrant doctor, I think sometimes you're seen as, well, we didn't have a UK-trained doctor, an overseas doctor. We didn't have a UK-trained doctor, so the next best thing is we'll get... And they have a completely different skill set. They have a different base of knowledge, a different set of things they've witnessed. And especially in their own country, they've seen that population and the specific health problems that have been affected by it. So in a multicultural, diverse society, they bring something that is lacking, and that they're able to, because you can't, you know, as UK trained or white doctors, you don't see as much patients from that community as they will ever have. So they're the only people can that really give you that knowledge and that learning. So, like,
I think that even goes way past like just medicine, like in general.
Oh yeah, definitely.
As a minority, you know what it's like to be in a setting where you're not the only, like, you're not all coming from the same community.
Yeah.
Whereas, and so it's rare for, like, a black person to say, oh, I feel uncomfortable because all of my colleagues are white.
Yeah.
Often, white people who are in majority settings, if they enter into a minority space, there's a lot of discomfort that they feel because they're not used to it. And so I think it's the same sort of thing that comes to medicine. Like, they're bringing something. Mm. They've already adapted to the white population or the English population.
Yeah.
And they're bringing their knowledge of their own communities.
So you need
whereas
to utilize
other people
that.
Only
yeah.
know one thing.
And that's why they shouldn't be just seen as, well, this is filling the gap. They should be seen like, well, how are we not utilizing this whole
asset,
especially in those, we know from the statistics that those patients are being negatively impacted. So why don't we use these doctors who have that knowledge and advocate for them? And I think we forget sometimes that doctors are highly skilled and highly trained people, like they're very, very trained doctors, like, you know, and especially a lot of doctors who come to the UK are like highly trained and the best of the best in their own field. So it's really strange that they then come to the UK and they're just seen like a lot of doctors as service providers, as means to an end, as like we said earlier, the carrot over the stick, keep working, keep spinning on the wheel, and instead of actually saying this is a whole resource that we, like exactly like the Nigerian obs and gynae doctors, with that you are having direct improved outcomes for patients. You can't argue.
Everyone's numbers look better. In the hospital's numbers look better. The patient's
It's a win-win.
It's just you don't lose at all.
It's a win-win.
And you respect the doctors. You see them as assets, as people, as value in their own right.
And it was such a cohesive team. They were such a cohesive team. It was just experts, you know, from different parts of the world, making such a positive measurable impact on their community. And that's ultimately what this is about.
Yeah.
Because so, we are a community, it's a group of people together, isn't it? And ultimately, that's what we're trying to do, right? So wouldn't you want to have that service that provides that to the community?
So I think wrapping up, y'all, which this was supposed to be a very short interlude. Instead, we've made an episode.
What do y'all... We spoke 3 hours about it.
Yeah, we did. It's been our entire 12-hour night shift. But
this is actually night shift delirium. We've actually come into the
12
end
hours in.
Of our shift. Yes.
So finishing up, y'all, steps forward, what is it that y'all want to see happen and what is it that you're committing yourselves to doing?
I mean, I still can't get over that black women are 5 times... That needs to change. For me, I think that's a crisis. That 5 times mortality than in the UK, that needs to change immediately. So that is something I really... I just can't be justified in a modern day healthcare system.
So how are you committing yourself? What actionable things are you going to do to try and work out that disparity?
That's a very good question. I mean, so I'm very interested in health, we've spoken about global health before. How I'm definitely actionably going to do it, that's a very good question. Well, I'm starting obs and gynae in October. So I think I need to reflect and work it out. And I'm doing an audit in this hospital in geriatric pregnancies. So maybe it needs to have a conversation about, can we audit black pregnancies and see what the outcomes are? And are we better than the statistic? Are we worse than the statistic? How are we meeting that? And even from... It doesn't have to be mortality in pregnancy. It could be gynae related. There's so many things. So I think that might be something I would definitely consider for a short-term goal. Long-term, I'm just going to try and be as vocal about my experience and making sure that I can support other people's experiences being told and being made to feel that their career is the best it can be and they never felt that they are succeeding despite any part of themselves. I want them to feel like they're succeeding because of every part of themselves, I think. That's probably...
Now you're just out here being a poet.
I know.
She's really giving it.
What about you, Dad?
So, like I've mentioned before, I've always believed in actively trying to improve representation. And sometimes, and representation for me is not just about black representation, it's also about representation amongst different classes and amongst, you know, just men, women and everything. So I do mentor a lot of people from underrepresented groups in terms of them trying to get into medicine or even trying to get into higher education. I am an advocate for education. I believe that education breaks down doors. I believe education puts you in spaces that often
gives you a voice.
Gives you a voice. And so I'm very into education advocacy amongst underrepresented groups.
Definitely.
So young working class boys, black boys in particular, black women. So that's something that I'm involved in and have been involved in even prior to becoming a doctor. And I guess it's also being comfortable, and I've always expressed the pride in whom I am, and I think that's a key element in diffusing the idea that I shouldn't be, and I think that's something that I definitely propagate in everywhere that I go to.
You bring it to work.
It's not a hidden thing.
I'm at work and now I've got my professional
absolutely
face on. I bring your Nigerian-ness and your culture to
in
work
my favour, and I think it is something that I will continue to do. I have, like Victoria said, I have a very diverse set of friends, and I'm not one person to not even listen to their experience. I want to hear all of us have an experience, whether white, black, Arab, whichever. And I believe that just having that conversation is very important. I love having that conversation. Questions, because I believe that conversation about us knowing ourselves more, knowing our experiences more, actually makes the team a lot more cohesive.
And talking about it.
And talking about it, and actually then opens more opportunities, because that's when I actually have those conversations with my consultants. Like, so, I mean, when we were at the dinner, Jack was like, oh, I watched your Channel 4 thing. And he said, I actually had to reflect on how have I ever said these kind of things to my juniors without knowing. And I'm having that conversation with my consultant. So it's, you know, being able to just not always, for me, present that you're a victim, because I'm not a victim. I am standing here as a black woman happy. There's nothing victimizing about being black, you know. But
and you can make change without it having to be because
yeah,
you're
so
a victim.
For me, it's about let us talk about who we are and let's be comfortable with that. Let's not say, oh, I don't want to say that because she's in the room, or I don't want to say that because that's in the room. And I believe that I'm that kind of person at work. I always try and open up those kind of conversations and make people feel comfortable with having that conversation. And that, like today, I'm sure has opened up so many things in people's minds. So that I think that's something that I proactively try to just do with my everyday. And, you know, try and encourage those coming up from behind me, whether it's a cousin or somebody, send somebody that wants to apply to medical school. You know, I have two young ladies that I mentioned at the moment who come from parts of London where it can be difficult to break the barriers. But because I've already gone ahead of them, I'm able to help them see the opportunities that they may not have been able to see or may have been taken away from them because of where they're being raised and because of the fact that they're black women. So I guess that's my little role. And being in this position in itself is an inspiration to somebody coming behind you.
Yes, certainly. So. Yes.
Well, thanks y'all for this extra bonus episode that
thanks,
we didn't know was going to happen.
And recording our musings.
All right. Thanks y'all.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Delirium. Hearing about the experiences of people who are members of the BAME community or minorities in the United Kingdom have been essential to my understanding of the minority experience here. And as it turns out, we're all just normal people. 2020 has provided a stage for Black Americans and their complicated relationship with the United States government and its history. Being abroad as a Black person who is American, it has been very interesting for me to see how other people interpret what's going on in America. I can't help but wonder what's going on with the minority experience for many people in the countries who stand in solidarity or have expressed support for Black people in America. As such, I wanted to get a better idea. England is certainly not excluded from that. And that's sort of what led to this conversation to begin with. There's a lot of work to be done to lead towards a more equitable world. And I believe firmly that it is important to amplify the voices of these minority communities. And just as Dot stated at the end of the episode, the importance of these conversations cannot be underestimated. I hope that you all take a page out of her book and go and have a chat with one of your coworkers to learn about their stories. It's Thanksgiving week in America, and even though I am far from home and currently in a lockdown, I do want to express gratitude to all of you, to my friends, to my family, to the people that I know and to the people that I've never met for your support of Night Shift Delirium. If you want to follow us on social media, follow us at Delirium Shift on Twitter and on Instagram at Night Shift Delirium. We're approaching the end of the season. We have just two more episodes left, so we will finish out the year with our final episode of season one. Thank you all for listening. Please be sure to share, like, discuss with your friends, and let us know what you're loving about the season so far. And lastly, I'll give you all one question to ask at your Thanksgiving Zooms this year. The same question that I asked the guests at the end of the episode. What actionable thing are you doing to create a more equitable world? See you on our next shift.
Say.
Message
followed
by the hash key.
I'm not even saying.
Anything.
Girl, it's not. You have never not known.
Yeah,
what
no,
to say.
But
don't
know. You should. You are orator.
God bless you, girls.
Right. So.